Continuing the description of Sri Vrindavan Dham in the 20th chapter of the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam. Earlier, in the verses prior to text 32 and 33, Srila Sukadev Goswami has described the beauty of Vrindavan in the rainy season. Raise your hand if you've been in Vrindavan in the rainy season. You certainly have. Yes? Sometimes it's not a very rainy season. But it's very, very, very beautiful. And especially beautiful. There's a special atmosphere in the rainy season. Practically speaking, in all the seasons of Vrindavan, there is a special atmosphere because Vrindavan means a special atmosphere. It has a sweetness that permeates it continuously. With each of the different seasons having its own flavor. So in Vrindavan, the beauty of that season plus some of the pastimes of that season were described in the verses prior to this. And the season and all the characteristics of the season with the rain and the clouds and the fresh grasses and the lightning and the thunder and the different clothes that one has to wear, these are all meant to facilitate the sweet dealings between Krishna and his most exalted devotees in Sri Vrindavan Dham, the Brijvasis. But in addition to the rainy season having its own sweetness, and this one experiences when one is in Vrindavan during the rainy season, that one is also very happy when it's over, because the next season is ready to come, and the next season will have its own sweetnesses, because the rains have come in the rainy season, and they have given given moisture to the parched earth of the summer season. But then it becomes very muddy, and no one can go outside. So when the next season comes, when the Indian summer or the beginning of the autumn comes, that is, and the cloud leave the sky, or they first become white instead of their darkish color. There is another special sweetness and beauty, and that's what's going to be described in the remaining verses of this chapter. So, in the next 18 texts, the fall season, the autumn season, is going to be described in Sri Vrindavan Dham. And again, each of these descriptions will be mixed with comparisons or metaphors. So along with the beauty, there are philosophical ideas that will be presented just in the positive and in the negative. Certain things that we should emulate and certain things that a devotee or an aspiring devotee shouldn't emulate. So in text 32, Evam nivasato tasmin ramakeshavayo braje sharat sama babad vyabhra vicham bravo purushanila. When Lord Rama and Lord Keshava were thus dwelling in Vrindavan, the fall season arrived. when the cloud, when the sky is cloudless, the water clear, and the wind gentle. These are the beginning of the characteristics of that season, the Sarat season. And of course, the Sarat season is most famous for the Sarat Purnim and the Rasa dance during that time. And the moon is very, very, very bright and very big. Text 33. I will read Sanatana Goswami's, Srila Sridhar Swami's comments, short comments to text 32. Srila Sridhar Swami says, the autumn is that season in which the clouds were absent, because all the clouds had, like wealthy persons who in time of difficulty for the population, they distribute their own wealth and they have nothing left. They are so magnanimous. So the clouds were compared to magnanimous persons because they were filled with rain and they distributed all their rain to the earth and nothing was left for themselves. So the autumn is that season in which the clouds were absent, in which the water was clear, and in which the wind was not harsh. In other words, all was peaceful. That's the comment of Srila Swami. So a wonderful peace settles in the atmosphere. Sanatana Goswami also has a short comment. The fact that Lords Krishna and Balaram were present is the reason for the particular opulences of the fall season. Thus the fall season next became fully manifest. Krishna and Balaram and all the Brijbasis in their pastime, they are like the jewel in the setting, the wonderful, brilliant jewels in the setting of the season of Sarat and all the different seasons. And text 33. The autumn season, which regenerated the lotus flowers. So here's one of the opulences of the autumn season, that the lotus flowers begin to blossom. The autumn season, which regenerated the lotus flowers, also restored the various bodies of water to their original purity, because during the rainy season, things will be muddy and brought to the surface. And then when the autumn season comes, the waters become very, very clear and transparent. The bodies of water to their original purity. Just, and here is the comparison, just as the process of devotional service purifies the minds of the fallen yogis when they return to it, when they turn to their devotional service. Sanatana Goswami comments on text 33 as follows. Just as the minds of those who have fallen, who have deviated at some time or other from the path of yoga because of various obstacles, and whose minds have become contaminated, they once again become purified. That's the comparison here. Because the contamination of the consciousness is not actually a part of the consciousness itself, any more than the mud, which perhaps may be stirred within water, it's not actually a part of the water. It's a suspended there, a colloidal suspension within the water. And then after some time, or by some part of the process, then that water settles, the mud settles and the water becomes clear. So similarly, the comparison is made that the contaminations which are born of the modes of goodness and passion and ignorance, but mostly passion and ignorance, these are what contaminate the consciousness. So when a purified person, a yogi who has not reached perfection, and this is true for all the different paths of yoga, when they, due to an obstacle, one obstacle or another, when they leave the path, what happens is that the modes of material nature and material desires are added to their pure consciousness and contaminates their consciousness. And then misery ensues. But then, if they come back to the purifying process, then their consciousness settles out all those impurities born of passion and ignorance. So that's the analogy given here. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, a short comment. Because of that false season, due to the autumn season, the lotus flowers blossom and the lakes become crystal clear. Similarly, by engaging in devotional service, the heart becomes purified and then Sri Krishna appears. Because two things are happening. The contamination settled, that's Cheto Dharpana Marjanam, Bhava Mahadavagni Navapanam, but Shreya Karaiva Chandrika, the lotus of one's good fortune blossoms. There's the cleansing of the contamination and there's the blossoming of something as well. And the blossoming is of one's spiritual life. And that cannot occur, practically speaking, until the contaminations are lessened or proportionate to how much they are lessened. One's spiritual life can blossom. So similarly, by engaging in devotional service, the heart becomes purified. And then Sri Krishna appears. The autumn season is compared to devotional service, the lake to the heart, and the appearance of Krishna is compared to the lotus. This is a positive example, one that should be emulated. Text 35, 34. Autumn clears the sky of clouds. Let the animals get out of their crowded living conditions, clean the earth of its covering of mud, and purify the water of contamination. In the same way that loving service rendered to Lord Krishna frees the members of the four spiritual orders from their respective troubles. I'll read that again, because these are the more effects of the autumn season. Autumn cleared the sky of clouds. The rainy season is done. Let the animals get out of their crowded living conditions, because when there is rain continuously falling, no one, even the animals, can go out. Everyone is seeking shelter from the rain. Clean the earth of its covering of mud, because the rainy season, it causes mud. And purify the water of contamination. It becomes again crystal clear, the waters. In the same way that loving service rendered to Lord Krishna frees the members of the four spiritual orders from their respective troubles. We'll read this part of the purport here. In the autumn season, the sky returns to its natural blue color. The vanishing of the clouds is like the vanishing of troublesome duties in brahmachari life. Just after summer comes, the rainy season, when the animals sometimes become disturbed by the torrential storms and thus huddle together. But the autumn season signals the time for the animals to go to their respective areas and live more peacefully. This represents a household as becoming free from the harassment of family duties and being able to devote more of his time to spiritual responsibilities, which are the real goal of life, both for himself and his family. The removal of the muddy layer on the earth is like the removal of the inconveniences of vanaprastha life, and the purification of the water is like the sanctification of sannyas life by one's preaching the glories of Krishna without sex desire. Read also the commentary of Srila Srila Swami on text 34. The autumn took away the respective four kinds of contamination of the four things, namely the sky and so forth. This is just like devotional service towards Lord Krishna takes away the inauspiciousness, the unhappiness of the members of the four spiritual orders of society, because there are austerities and difficulties in every order of the society of each of the different ashramas. There are difficulties. So now he's going to describe the difficulties as the purport here described, the difficulties in each of the different ashramas and how devotionals at a different point these are removed. So thus his devotional service eliminates the difficulties of the brahmacharis, such as having to fetch water for their spiritual master and so forth. Because such a successful brahmachari who is filled with that devotional service is not engaged in such a thing, even by his superiors, because it would be unfitting for him. In the same way, the autumn season took away the cloud from the sky. Very interesting comment by Śrīla Śrīla Swāmī. That brahmachari life is meant for studying, and it is meant for a specific type of austerity, where one places oneself under authority, because it is training for the rest of one's life. Because when one is under authority under the guru in the brahmachari ashram or whatever authority it is, then one has to neglect one's own mind for the superior authority, and one is engaged continuously, practically speaking, in menial service, study and menial service, study menial service. These are the two main engagements of brahmacharis. And that menial service, obviously, is troublesome on a particular level because it's menial. There's physical austerities involved. There's so many in the Upanishads. There's a story of one brahmachari, I can't remember his name, but he was engaged in just taking care of the cows of his spiritual master, and then and his spiritual master didn't call him to eat, so he drank some of the cow's milk, and the spiritual master saw that he wasn't feeding him anything, and yet the brahmachari was always fatty. So he said, "How are you getting fatty?" And he said, "Oh, I'm just drinking." He was very innocent. He said, "I'm just drinking the milk of the cows." And he said, "No, you can't do this. This isn't yours. You can't do that." So he took away that food, and still he wouldn't call him for eating. And then he found another way to eat that was very, very simple also. And then the spiritual master saw that he wasn't getting thin. And he asked him, "How are you eating?" And he told him, he said, "No, you can't do that." So on and on, he took away all the different ways that this brahmachari was able to sustain himself by eating, and he still wouldn't give him anything. And then finally he was wandering around and trying to do his service, but he was becoming so weak with hunger, and he fell into a ditch or something and became blind. So it was very extreme austerities. But then, by the grace of God, because he was so sincere and so pure in following the system of brahmacharya and his obedience to his spiritual master, then he was blessed with all knowledge. And all knowledge became revealed to him due to his purity and sincerity and his full dependence on Krishna. But this, obviously, is from a different age and extremely rare. But the point being that brahmachari life has its austerities attached to it. And when even a brahmachari, when he becomes exalted in Krishna consciousness, as the verse is saying, the difficulties of the austerities are removed, because even for a brahmachari, it is not fitting for him, one whose consciousness is illuminated by Krishna consciousness, is not fitting for him to be engaged in menial service. So the spiritual master will recognize that and not engage him in that way. That's the point of Śrīla Swāmī. How Krishna consciousness or devotional service removes that austerity. Just as devotional service takes away the tumult of associating with children and so forth for the householders, by bringing about within them a taste for dwelling in seclusion. Similarly, the autumn season takes away the confusion of living entities. So this is the great pleasure of householder life, but it's the great confusion, actually, because brahmachari basically has one problem, and that is his mind. And if he deals with that, he's okay. Then when marriage comes, at least there's two minds to deal with. And then next step, there's three minds to deal with, and everyone is making demands, and four minds to deal with, and five minds, and everyone is saying, me, 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 me. So, and the analogy here is that it detaches householders. Devotional service will detach a householder from, and it's funny, the tumult of associating with children and so forth. A tumult. And it brings within them a different type of a desire, the desire for dwelling in seclusion. The autumn season takes away the confusion of living entities. Tumult means confusion. And what has to happen is one's consciousness has to come down to deal with children. It just must be like that, practically speaking. Because children do not have the conceptual ability to think in an elevated way, obviously. They don't attain their conceptual abilities don't mature until they're 16 or so. Then they become basically adults. And just as devotional service to Sri Krishna takes away the contamination of lusty desires and other impure thoughts on part of the sannyasi, similarly the autumn season has taken away the contamination of the water. So this is the great struggle for someone who is renounced, who's taken the heavy vows like Bhishma Dev took of Nrida, the Brihadvrat, of no association with women. So the difficulty is, well, what happens if one's consciousness is not purified sufficiently? Then there is a torture, even if one is in the renounced order of life, because one is going against one's desires, and the mind can be very, very heavy in this regard. And it has caused the downfall of so many in the renounced order, so many. So Krishna consciousness removes that austerity by purifying the heart so much, by one's fully surrendering to Krishna, and by one's taking shelter of Krishna and living in the consciousness, I am a servant of Krishna. And one's actual consciousness, one's false ego, one's enjoying spirit is dissolved. This is the meaning of Kapila Muni's explanation in the third canto that devotional service dissolves the subtle body. It dissolves the sense of being separate from Krishna. And then, when one is living in the consciousness of I am Krishna's servant, and one is developing love for Krishna, and love, and one's desire actually becomes to please Krishna, and one is removed, one's false ego is dissolved, means that one is no longer thinking of oneself as the center of existence. One's in love. One wants to please Krishna. And then that the nasty desire of sex desire, which so much pollutes and contaminates the heart and the consciousness, and it places one in the mood of being the enjoyer. It's such a contaminant for that reason. The exact opposite of love. Krishnendriya priti, atmendriya priti. Just opposite. One is love and one is lust. So when one is free from that, when one is so deep in one's own Krishna consciousness, one's love for Krishna, that one is freed from that, then one is free, actually free from material life. So a sannyasi, one in the renounced order who is free, becomes free from that, from sex life, he is in Krishna consciousness, awards that, then he is purified fully and free from the greatest of burdens. And then, like Sukadev Goswami, and he's speaking this, and he knows he had no distinction in his consciousness based on the bodies between male and female, even. What an incredible state of consciousness. Just saw the soul. Vidyavanaya sampanem brahmani gavihastanem suni chaiva so pakecha pandita samadarshana sama darshana. Everywhere he looked, he saw that one who was with the Supreme Ma, ultimately Srimati Radharani or Lakshmi Narayan. He saw sees Radha and Krishna and Lakshmi Narayan or Sitaram or the Super Soul in everyone's heart. This is true vision. Obviously, it's very, very rare. No bodily conception. How exalted. How fearless that is. No bodily conception. How one can wander in this world. Vishra Purna Sukhayate. No fear, no anxiety. Because one's vision is pure. One sees oneself in relationship to Krishna. Nothing having to do with the body. Seeing everything. This is Uttama Bhagavad. Everything only in relationship to Krishna. So therefore one purport of the Bhagavad Gita Prabhupada describes this as the consciousness of a devotee just living in Krishna, living in the mercy of Krishna. He sees nothing but the mercy of Krishna. Vishnu Purna Sukhayate. Wonderful. Text 35. The clouds, having given up all they possessed, shone forth with purified effulgence. They're no longer darkish. They're effulgent and white because they've divested themselves of the rain. They are just like peaceful sages who have given up all material desires and are thus free from all sinful propensities. Purport. When the clouds are filled with water, they are dark and cover the sun's rays. Just as the material mind of an impure man covers the soul shining within. So what covers the soul? The material mind. Yes, the mind is filled with so many desires, all born of passion and ignorance. It is the mind. Bandharatmatmanastasya yena maiva manajitaha. It becomes the friend or the enemy when it's filled with material desires and leading us around like a bull is led around. A big powerful bull is led around by a little boy who has a ring through his nose, and the bull is so powerful and the little boy is just a little boy and he pulls him by that rope. So similarly, we become led around by the mind when it is filled with material desires. Balad even ayojitaha, powerful, and it forces one to act against one's will, practically speaking. And this is if one's conscious, one recognizes it's against one's will, but most people are unconscious of it. There's such a full identification with the mind. As soon as the mind grabs onto something, the person wants it and he goes in that direction. That's the depth of illusion, or the tightness of the rope is so powerful, there's no slack at all. There's a complete identification of the person with the mind and its desires. So of course this is very dangerous. It is the dangerous thing. And it's because one is capable of doing anything. And we see this in the world. There are people who do the craziest things. And sometimes when they're brought to and to the court they say that, you know, that when they'll shoot people, there was they'll shoot people. There was one lady recently, she stabbed her and killed her husband. He was doing something that he shouldn't have been doing, and she stabbed him, you know, 25 times and killed him or something like that. Because the mind, when it becomes filled with something in ignorance or passion, it's capable of doing anything. And it's so influenceable. And it becomes the totality of reality, what the mind happens to be experiencing at that moment. So much so, in anger, you know, that people can shoot. Have old men and old ladies and children dig their own graves and then shoot them and then cover them, and they're always uncovering these things when there's been wars, all these mass graves, because the mind of the people that influence these people are our enemies, and we have to do this. And it's, what do they have to do? Something completely crazy, and they do it willingly. Someone shoots someone else to teach him a lesson, shoots him in the head. Crazy. This is the mind, capable of anything, practically speaking, anything. If the mind focuses on something, it can do anything. So this is this is actually the only enemy in the world. And Krishna calls Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, Mahabaho, O mighty armed, anyone who can conquer this enemy is truly mighty armed. Cease identifying with the mind's desires when it is contaminated by passion, ignorance, and then allow the not engaged in those and purify the heart, the Taito Dapan Rajanam, and then the lotus of our good fortune can blossom, our Krishna consciousness, and then Bandhuratma Manastasya. The mind can become a friend when it has an attachment, like the residents of Vrindavan. They only know one thing. And that thing isn't a thing, he's a person, it's Krishna. They don't know anything but Krishna. Their minds are so fully spiritualized and in love with Krishna, so illuminated by Krishna's, by the internal energy of Krishna. They know nothing but Krishna. They know nothing but Krishna. They talk about nothing but Krishna. They think about nothing but Krishna and serving Him. Then that kind of mind is the greatest of friends, and that's perfection. So when... I'll read this purport again. Again, it's short. But when the clouds pour down their rain, they become white and then brilliantly reflect the shining sun, just as a man who gives up all material desires and sinful propensities becomes purified and then brilliantly reflects his own soul and the supreme soul within. This is wonderful. One becomes brilliant. That's why whenever you see in any religion, any religious picture, you see a saint. Either it's Christian, or Christians have it more than anywhere else, but they you always see a big halo of effulgence coming from them. And, but Krishna, of course, even though the picture is and here too, there's effulgence just coming from his head, but it's not actually supposed to just be coming from his head. There's Krishna, every part of him is completely effulgent. But this is true. And someone who is purified has an effulgence, gives a spiritual energy. One time, Zagatrini and I, we were sitting with, should I tell the secret? We were sitting with this man who could read auras. And he was looking at me and saying, it's blue, it's this, it's that. And he looked at Zagatrini. So bright and yellow. It's yellow, it's big, and it's filling up everything. It's like Trini's singing. Remember that? And then later she said, you know what my secret was? I was going, Radhe, 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 Radhe. You remember that? So if we just do that, just keep that going on all the time. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna. Then we will evolve it. Because that actually is the natural consciousness of every soul. To be always just that, the thought, the name, just going on continuously, that love for Krishna. And one can't do that unless one loves Krishna. So all material desires finished, sinful propensities finished, one becomes purified and then brilliantly reflects his own soul and the Supreme Soul within. Then Shri Sanatana Goswami comments, text 35. Simply by dint of having given up all desires, they are peaceful, free of attachment, etc. This is the clouds. Again, I'll read the verse. The clouds, having given up all they possessed, shone forth with spiritual effulgence. What was the thing that the cloud gave up? The rain, all its water that it was carrying. That's the darkness. Compared to peaceful sages who have given up all material desires and are thus free of all sinful propensities. So Sanatana Goswami says, simply by dint of having given up all desires, they are peaceful, free of attachment, etc. By whom sin has been given up, including giving up dry knowledge, which is equal to sin, because then it is an obstacle to devotional service. Dry knowledge means what? It means knowledge, the desire for Brahman. Probably everyone is sitting here going, Radhe, 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 Radhe. Now everyone, the room is becoming too effulgent. Very interesting. The sages by whom sin has been given up includes dry knowledge, giving up dry knowledge, which is equal to sin because it is an obstacle to devotional service. Everything, every desire, every tendency in the consciousness that is not a Krishna conscious desire and tendency is an obstacle to devotion. Ultimately, this is the simple reality of it. Of the situation, because there's Krishna, there's love for Krishna and moving towards Krishna, and then there's so many other desires which born of the modes of material nature which cause us fill the consciousness with other things other than pleasing Krishna, including the desire to become one with the Lord, just focusing one's consciousness on tattvamasi, Brahmananda, because there is no bhakti in it. There is no love for Krishna in that. It is ultimately selfish. Even though it is pure in the sense of amal, free from anything material, it is ultimately the final product of false ego. It is not beyond false ego. Similarly, there is a comparison to the pure effulgence of the cloud, and therefore this is just as the jnanis who become devotees shine forth rajanti, sobhanti, even more than previously. So when those jnanis who are pure, when they become devotees, when they develop love for Krishna, then they shine so wonderfully, so wonderfully. Text 36. During the season, this season, oops, I didn't read Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur's comment to text 35. Short comment. As munis become purified by giving up all sinful propensities and material desires, and material desires to attain sons, wealth, and followers. Similarly, after expelling all their rain, the clouds become pure and white in color. This is a positive analogy. To attain son, wealth, and followers. And most difficult to give up is that desire for followers. And labha, puja, pratishtati, yata, upasakagam. These are the most dangerous of weeds in one's devotional service, to be the desire to be worshipped and to have followers. Because ultimately, any desire other than to be a servant. One can have followers, one can be worshipped, but one, like Prabhupada had so many followers, so many great Gaudiya Vaishnavas had followers, so many. Prabhupada was worshipped every day, everywhere he went, he was worshipped. And when he came to Australia, and they picked him up in a Rolls Royce, and they tried to give Prabhupada trouble about that. And he said, "Why have they picked you up in a Rolls Royce?" And Prabhupada's comment, and I paraphrase, was because this actually isn't good enough. Because they picked me up in a Rolls Royce because they didn't have any solid gold cars available, something like that. And he could do that. He could be so bold because there was no desire in there. It was just as a servant. He could be so bold because of the purity. It is the desire. It is the false ego that is the cause of the problems. It is the false ego. There's nothing bad in this material world. The material world, nirbande, Krishna sambande, yukta varagyunchate. It is all Krishna's energy. There's nothing bad in it. So the devotee, a pure soul, has neither attachment nor aversion to this world. But what must be given up is not the world, because obviously it's not ours to give up, but it's that desire to enjoy the world. That is what is to be given up. Text 36. During this season, the mountains sometimes released their pure water, and sometimes did not. Just as experts in transcendental science sometimes give the nectar of transcendental knowledge and sometimes do not. I'll read that again. During this season, the mountains sometimes released their pure water and sometimes did not. Just as experts in transcendental knowledge, transcendental science, sometimes give the nectar of transcendental knowledge and sometimes do not. There's one interesting comment in this. I mean, this is I remember years and years ago reading this and always trying to understand why. Sometimes there's nothing that anyone can do to force someone to give who's a deep transcendentalist. They sometimes wish to, by the inspiration of Krishna, they sometimes wish to give to preach or give their transcendental knowledge, which is generally their tendency. And sometimes they do not. Here's the purport. The first part of this chapter describes the rainy season, and the second part has been dealing with the autumn season, which begins when the rain stops. During the rainy season, water always flows from the mountains, but during the autumn, the water sometimes flows and sometimes does not. Similarly, great saintly teachers sometimes speak expansively on spiritual knowledge, and sometimes they are silent. The self-realized soul is closely in touch with the Supreme Soul, and according to his, Krishna's desire, a competent spiritual scientist may or may not describe the absolute truth, depending on the specific circumstances. Srila Sridhar Swami comments on this. The idea of this verse, beginning, Giraya, this is Girayo Mamuchus Toyam. The mountains, Mamuchu, release Toyam, their water. kvachit, sometimes, nam mamuchu, sometimes they did not release. The idea of this verse beginning with Gira, this is again Srila Sridhar Swami's comment, the jnanis do not disseminate the nectar of transcendental knowledge everywhere as do ordinary teachers with the knowledge of fruit of work. So Srila Sridhar Swami is taking this as jnanis who don't give their transcendental knowledge everywhere, and karmakandiya people, or knowledge, those who preach about karma, they do. As do ordinary teachers with knowledge of fruit of work, but rather they mercifully do sometimes. Similarly, sometimes the mountains release their auspicious pure water and sometimes they do not. They do not, however, as they did in the rainy season, give off the water in all circumstances. Same as the purport here. So Sanatana Goswami comments. The verse beginning Gireya has been explained by Sridhar Swami. But the alternative explanation may be given that they sometimes release the water as auspicious and pure and sometimes as not pure, but rather dirty because there being hardly any rain. They were keeping only that water that remains from the flooding. It's a little bit hard to understand the exact meaning here. This is just as those who know the truth release jnanamritam, super excellent knowledge, which has its subject matter, the glories of devotional service at the proper time. So that's the word here. Jnanamritam, the knowledge of jnana. So therefore, Srila Swami, the Amrita, knowledge of jnana. Srila Swami has commented on that specifically. But listen to what Sanatana Goswami says now. When their disciples develop extraordinary love, they give it to him. That knowledge. This is the cause. This is what causes the jnanamritam to be released. When the disciples develop extraordinary love, they give jnanamritam to them, the nectar of knowledge. But at other times, they give insignificant knowledge dealing with the subject matters of the soul and so forth. So he's speaking of the, not the jnanis, but of the, as an alternative meaning, of the exalted devotees. When the disciples develop extraordinary love, when they're developed, then they bestow jnanamritam, very, very high, wonderful spiritual knowledge. But otherwise, they'll give insignificant knowledge when the disciples are not yet qualified with devotional love, extraordinary love. And other times they get insignificant knowledge dealing with the subject matters of the soul and so forth. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, the jnanis such as Narada, Lal Bharat and Prahlad give the nectar of knowledge, instructions about the truth of the Supreme Personality of Godhead to such persons as, so the jnanis, these are the ultimate jnanis, they have the true and ultimate knowledge of Krishna, of Bhagavad Tattva. So who did Narada give it to? The hunter, Magrari, Vishwanath says. And Jadbarat gave it to? Rahugana. And Prahlad? To the children of the demons in the Asura Kula. But otherwise, they do not give such knowledge, and thus this analogy should be accepted as favorable for those who want to become successful in life. This is the nature of the mountains, simply and inconceivably. And logical argument cannot be applied to that fact. So Vishwanath said, very interesting, this is just the nature of the mountains, and this is the nature of devotees. They give where they want to give, and where they don't want to give, they just simply don't do it. And no one can force it. Something, some quality in someone may pull it from them, or they just may be exceedingly merciful at some time. And whether there is quality or not, they just give jnanamritam, the highest of knowledges that awards the highest of taste, of the highest of devotional service. And he says again, this is simply the nature of mountains, simply and inconceivably. And logical argument cannot be applied to that fact. Well, why do they do this and why do they do that? But also, Srila Swami said, or they have some inspiration from Krishna. Or as Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur explains in Madhurya Kadamari, the Madhyam devotees, they actually have free will. And it's not a fault that they give when they want to give. This is just simply their free will and desire. And there's no logic or argument, it's just their free will. The idea to be deduced is that if they were to distinguish the fitness of the qualities of candidates, then both their equal vision and unconditional quality of their mercy would be contradicted. Vishwanath has made the same point in Madhurya Kadambari, right in the beginning of that. Because a sadhu has equal vision, and also he has mercy. So what will cause him to give to one person or another then, if he sees equally and he's merciful? So that means he's equally merciful to everyone. So Vishwanath says this is just the free will. And that's what he explains in Madhurya Kadambari. It is just simply he wants to. This is his individuality. Fascinating. 37 and 38. We'll read these together. And then I think we'll read up to, let's see how far. Maybe we'll see. Many fascinating points in these analogies here. 37 and 38 all have to do with fish and water. The fish, swimming about in the increasingly shallow water, did not at all understand that the water was diminishing. Just as foolish family men cannot see how the time they have left to live is diminishing with every passing day. And then the next verse speaks about the same point a little further. Just as a miserly, poverty-stricken person, overly absorbed in family life, suffers because he cannot control his senses, the fish swimming in the shallow water had to suffer the heat of the autumn sun. So the second verse is in response to a comment that can be made on the first verse, that the fish don't see that their small pond is diminishing, because during the rainy season the pond is filled. You see this in the park where we live in Gopinath Dham, the park, there are so many areas, the lowlands that are filled with water, and the ducks are really enjoying in there, and the geese are splashing around. But every day, not quite yet, but when the rains end, every day there's less and less water. So the fish that are in there, every day the water is diminishing. It brings them one, just a day closer to their death, and they're not aware of it. So the objection could be made, well, ignorance is bliss. And this is the objection that's already given, very many times given, that in our next life we may be something, some kind of an animal, and then the person says, well, I won't know it. So therefore, I won't know that I'm an animal. I won't know that I was a human last time, so I'll be happy enjoying doggish pleasures. So ignorance is bliss. But to that example, or that objection, the next verse says, just as miserly, poverty-stricken persons overly absorb in family life, because the comparison to the fish was in family life, they suffer because they cannot control their senses. The fish swimming in the shallow water has to suffer the heat of the autumn sun. So it is not that ignorance is bliss. Ignorance is misery. Because the sun, in the example, makes the fish suffer. The water heats up. The smaller the pond is, the more the hotter the water becomes, and they don't like it. It causes suffering. So it's not that the ignorant person whose whole life, his whole existence is his family life. It is not that he, in his ignorance, is enjoying family life. He's being kicked continuously and suffering, dealing with all the minds that he has to deal with. Everyone wanting. So the comment here, the purport here, is short. After the rainy season, the water gradually goes down, but stupid fish do not understand this. Usually we would say something a little more gentle than there, but stupid fish do not understand this. Thus they are often stranded on the lake shores and riverbanks. Similarly, those infatuated with family life do not understand that the remainder of their life is constantly decreasing, and thus they fail to perfect their Krishna consciousness and are stranded in the cycle of birth and death. And the other, the purport to the second one. Although, as described in the previous verse, unintelligent fish, that's a little more gentle, or foolish fish, or unintelligent fish, are not aware of the diminishing water, one may think these fish are still happy according to the old proverb, ignorance is bliss. But even the ignorant fish are scorched by the autumn sun. Similarly, although an attached family man may consider his ignorance of spiritual life blissful, he is constantly disturbed by the problems of family life, and indeed his uncontrolled senses lead him into a situation of unrelieved anguish. We'll read the comments of Sanatana Goswami and Vishwanath to these two verses, 36, 37. Because they are swimming in Sanatana Goswami, because they are swimming in shallow water, they should be understood as petty, and therefore they do not appreciate that the water, which is compared to one's lifespan, is diminishing. Foolish persons, those without discrimination, who are overly attached to wife, children, and so forth, which two adjectives relate to status of being a householder, with the two respective qualities of being petty and traveling in shallow water. Nonetheless, they remain in this way despite their having directly experienced the death of their fathers and so on. It is with this idea they are called foolish and compared with fish living in the water. Or else it is being stated that the fish are capable of understanding that the water is diminishing since they are traveling in shallow water. But still they did not appreciate the fact because they were foolish. They lacked intelligence. In that same way, the householders are also foolish. And in the thing being compared, the fish being compared to the life of a householder, there is ample opportunity to acquire knowledge of the diminishing of one's lifespan from having seen the death of family members and so on. So very, very pointed. These analogies are very, very strong. As are the comments. Yeah, slaps in the face. Sanatana Goswami says to text 38, and it is not that they, the fish, were happy on account of being freed from fear, since they had no knowledge that the water is diminishing, but rather they suffered great distress, as stated by the verse beginning Gada. The repetition of this idea in this second verse is to make firm the idea of how they receive suffering, and in order to show how those who travel in deep water, the devotees, do not experience the same. So a wonderful point and wonderful instruction and admonition that we should be deep, travel in deep water, whether we are brahmacharis or householders or vanaprastas or sannyasis. As we heard before, that devotional service removes all the misery of all these different ashramas. But here the point is being specifically made by Sanatana Goswami that even fish are not disturbed if they have water, a life that's deep. So there is the admonition. Go deeply into the waters of Krishna consciousness, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. By the words generated by the autumn sun, is expressed the sharp severity of their suffering, because after the rainy season ends and the coolingness of the rain is gone in Vrindavan, all that heat, it's really piercing, burning, glaring heat. Very intense. Daridra means lacking wealth, and more specifically, kripana, pain by the endeavor to earn wealth, and even more specifically, kutumbi, these are the words used, excessively interested in wealth for the sake of maintaining wife, children, and so forth. And even more pointedly, avijitendriya, meaning interested in prestige. Therefore, he obtains the threefold miseries, or else an excess of suffering. Very, very heavy, but pointed and very kind and merciful. And now we'll read Vishnu's comments on these two verses. 37 and 38. As an ignorant man attached to his family does not realize that his lifespan is decreasing at every moment, foolish fish play in the shallow water, not realizing that it is decreasing at every moment. This is a negative analogy, one that we are exhorted not to follow. And this is his comment on 38. As a poor man suffers while supporting a large family, so the fish in scarce water must endure the painful heat of the autumn sun. In the previous verse, a wealthy man was described, whereas here the negative effects of a poor family man are described. Well, this verse can be taken to refer to the suffering of the attached family man mentioned in the previous verse. Okay, we'll read just one more. 39, and then we'll stop. Gradually, the different areas of land gave up their muddy condition, and the plants grew past their unripe stage. In the same way that sober sages give up egotism and possessiveness, these are based on things different from the real self, namely the material body and its byproducts. Also very strong. The word adishu in this verse indicates the byproducts of the body, such as children, home, and wealth. This is what is given up. And the egotism and possessiveness, the sober sages give all this up. And read the comment of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur to text 39. Short comment. As the intelligent person gives up everything unrelated to the soul, the Paramatman, Krishna, namely the body, false ego, and possessiveness, and tries to develop attachment to Krishna, so the fields gave up their muddy condition and plants gave up their unripe state. Okay. So we'll continue on Friday, Krishna willing, and we'll finish the chapter. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srila Vrindavan Dham ki jai, Gaur Bhaktivedanta ki jai. Any questions or comments?
Materialistic person thinks that devotees focus on death as an organ. May acknowledge that they've got to die as an organ. And I think that if we start thinking about it, then life becomes very depressing. So how do we get them past that point?
How do we get past that point? Or how do we get them past the point? Well, we have to be awake to real life. The idea of the shaking of the sleeping man is not to cause him trouble. He's having a bad dream, and he doesn't know he's even dreaming. You know, the tiger is ripping him apart. I once had a dream. Actually, I had a dream I was being attacked by a tiger. Did you? Only one time. I was a Nagababa. And I was walking in a forest, big bearded, wearing clothed by the four directions. And sometimes they carry these axes. And I was walking through the forest, and there was a big tiger on a rock. And he attacked me. And he jumped on me. And they're very, very powerful and strong, these Nagababas. And he attacked me. And because he had my arm, I couldn't hit him with the axe. And as I was dying, I was saying, only if I had an axe in my other hand. And I'd whack him. And I died like that. And I woke up, I guess in my next life, I had two axes instead of one. But if you're being ripped apart by a tiger, it's quite unpleasant. And you're dreaming that. It has nothing to do with your real life. And someone's shaking you. And why are you thinking, why is this person bothering me? So this talk about death is a shaking. It's not at all pleasant to think that this body that I'm so attached to is going to die. It's so unpleasant. And my parents have died, and my children are going to die, and my wealth is going to be taken away. And this, it's not very pleasant. It gives one a quite an upset feeling in one's mind and stomach. But that shaking is just to wake us up. And as we become awake to our real life, if we can become awake to thinking of Krishna, thinking and talking about Krishna, then we want to wake up. We want to be awake. We want to get on with the real thing. So it's really not this type of speaking about death is not actually devotional preaching. It's more the preaching of and the miseries of material life and householders and this and that. And it is not actually the preaching for the devotional preaching, because devotional preaching is detached. It's neutrality when viewing the material world. This type of thing is quite averse to everything in the material world, which is really a jnani type of preaching. But it is required at certain times, like the shaking is required. The devotees' preaching is that everything is Krishna's. This body is Krishna's. The big Rolls Royce is Krishna's. The opulent this is Krishna's. So let me use it in Krishna's service. And you know, when it drops, okay, the mind is on Krishna. So really, far from the devotional consciousness being obsessed with the negativity of the material world, it's quite the opposite. It's obsessed with the wondrousness of Krishna. But because we're not perhaps quite at that stage, we need the shaking. So that's the mercy. It's merciful when someone will take the trouble to shake us, even though that's not their pleasure. How do you know about the one when you weren't here, though? Must be a deep point. Either that or ununderstandable. What is it? What is this mysterious thing? Oh, compassion. Misery. Yeah. This is how Krishna shows his compassion in the world. Because compassion, the concept of compassion is that I've suffered and I know what it's like, and I don't want to see someone else suffer in this way. So the question is, can Krishna truly experience compassion? Because he cannot experience suffering. He can't suffer because his very nature is Satchidananda. His nature is bliss. So So how to resolve this? Although if he can't be compassionate, who wants, you know, it's a lack for him, it appears. So how for Krishna resolve this by through his devotees? So they carry his compassion. He inspires them with his kripa shakti, his mercy. But it's Krishna, but this is how Krishna does it. Pretty esoteric, isn't it? Because the devotees, the devotees who have come up in the material world certainly have so many suffering experiences. Is there anyone who can't say that they know what it's like to suffer? Yeah, how about you? Yeah, are you sure? Are you sure? Okay. So therefore, a good-hearted soul, even though he may not be suffering, someone who has truly come to devotional service in a deep way, he may not be suffering. But his suffering is that he sees the suffering of others. So therefore, that inspiration, that's Krishna's kripa shakti, actually, is his potency of mercy. And therefore, he cannot tolerate that. This is a good person. He cannot tolerate to see this suffering of another. Like the clouds, they expend all their energy. So therefore, they're glorified as an example to follow. Even at the depletion of their own energy, at great cost, they cannot tolerate to see that. This is the nature of a sadhu. They cannot tolerate to see the suffering of another. This is the madhyam sadhu. Or even high. Yes? But he doesn't like this. How can anyone tolerate to see the suffering of another?
Because he knows what they're going through, therefore he feels for them
all. Yeah. This is how Krishna feels for his devotees. Just like he says in the Bhagavatam, he eats for the Brahmins. Okay, it's late. Okay, quick question, quick answer. No difference. Because one doesn't see this. Because the spiritual master means representative of Krishna. But, they're not different. It's internal energy, holds internal energy. And the love for the spiritual master is the seed that blossoms into love for Krishna. It's not different. Bhagavatam ki jai.